first lecture. So one of the ways to make some Gutenberg curve into something complete only requires information from four dimensional field theory. So it requires you to look at something called surface operators. That will be the first half of the lecture. And the second half of the lecture, I'm going to use instead a six-dimensional engineering for structure, which produces four-dimensional theories, and at the same time gives, again, a concrete meaning to this curve associated to the theory. So when I talk about surface operators, I mean four-dimensional true defects in R4. And I want to study, again, defects which preserve half of the supercharges. Now, these defects, again, break two translations, preserve two translations. So I have to pick a specific subset of supercharges which commute only to anti-commute to preserve translations. Now, from the point of view of the volume of the surface operator, this the bulk supercharges have chirality, positive, negative chirality. And you can decide how many bulk supercharges with a certain chirality to preserve. There are different possible choices, but the surface operators I care about preserve two-dimensional surface symmetry. So I want to preserve two chiral supercharges and two anti-chiral supercharges. Now, two true theories are very well studied, essentially because they were the basic object that appears in Calabi-Yau compactification, so string theory. And they have lots of beautiful properties, and a lot can be computed about them. And they actually have an uncanny similarity to any two theories of four dimensions. Some time ago, the similarity was explained by the fact that if you look at vortices in a four-dimensional theory, these can carry, they can behave like two-dimensional theories. But it's actually a bit cleaner in itself thinking about vortices, which are dynamical objects. Just think in terms of surface operators, which are non-dynamical objects. In a sense, if you had a vortex in the Higgs branch of a theory, and you flow to the infrared, so the expectation value of the Higgs branch becomes infinite, what you're left with is a surface operator in the surviving four-dimensional theory. So if you look at two-dimensional theories with two-comma-two supersymmetry, you can have true charges, one rotating left moving, right moving supercharges the same way. There's a vector of charge. And then there could be an axial charge rotating the supercharges in different directions. Usually when you have both vector and axial charge unbroken, non-anomalous, you have a super conformal 2.2 theory. But today, I focus on the massive 2.2 theories. I would assume that at least one of the true charges is preserved because it descends from S2R, the four-dimensional theory, which is unbroken in the Coulomb branch, and I want to study the four-dimensional theory in the Coulomb branch. So I want to understand how the surface operators of the ultraviolet theory behave in the infrared if they move in the Coulomb branch of the four-dimensional theory. And so the behavior of the surface operator is more or less the same. It's closely related to the behavior of 2.2 two-dimensional sigma models, massive sigma models. So, the most basic property of this two-dimensional sigma model, massive sigma model, is that in the infrared, they don't have any massless degrees of freedom. So you have a certain set, discrete set of background for your theory. Very often, these sigma models have deformations in the ultraviolet. What are called twisted couplings. Which I denote as CI. They're called twisted couplings because they appear in a twisted sort of fashion. So, I don't want to go into details of the superspace for these models, but basically, you can have a you can define things like chiral fields or anti-chiral or twisted chiral fields, which are healed by different choices of the four supercharges. The twisted chiral fields are the ones that are not charged under U and R. So you can add a twisted super potential involving these twisted chiral fields without breaking the U and R symmetry. The vector U and R symmetry of the theory. Now, another important property of this theory is that they're a twisted chiral ring. So there is a bunch of operators which form a ring. There is a particular set of operators which you can use to change the twisted couplings of the theory. So you can send z to z plus delta z by adding the index R function. By adding a twisted superpotential term with this XI sort of specific set of twisted chiral fields instead of covering. So, in a sense, this vacuum corresponds to the different solutions to covering. So they are labeled by the expectation value of operators, which have to satisfy these ring relations. The coefficient of these ring relations might depend very well on twisted couplings. And if you consider, so in general, the theory would have a certain parameter space, some complicated manifold in which the Zi's live. And above each choice of parameters, you have the vacuum of your theory. And as you change the parameters, the vacuum of the theory will be fibered in an interesting fashion. It might be permuted among themselves. So you end up getting a complicated surface. Which projects down on the parameter space. I will denote the parameter space as C and the cover or this cover of the parameter space as sigma. And now it should be once you are on sigma, you can define the expectation values of those twisted chiral operators, and then you get for free a one form of sigma. Okay, and the reason I'm using the same symbol I use for subwavelet differential and subwavelet curve is completely identical. Not a very well constructed case. So. Anyway, so now this theory, the square symmetry algebra of two-dimensional models include a central charge. And if you consider the theory in a segment on a line with different choices of vacua, the two ends, you can get BPS domain walls, the dynamical BPS domain wall between the vacuum, which essentially are just like the BPS particles in four dimensions. The mass of these domain walls satisfies the BPS bound, and for BPS domain walls can be written as difference in the value of the twisted square potential for the true vacuum. Now, I told you that you can change the superpotential, but you can move in the parameter space of vacuum by changing the twisted superpotential this way. So you can imagine now, so if you want to compare the value of the superpotential at different values, on different vacuum, what you can do is just to take a straw around parameter space along some path gamma, ij, which joins xi and xi j of this core. So as long as everything is connected, to assume that everything is connected, the central charge can be written as a path integral. As a contour integral of lambda. Now this should start looking familiar. Another possible way of deforming the theory is available if the theory has some flavor symmetries. The theory has flavor symmetries. Much like in four dimensions, you can get mass parameters, which live in the Cartan flavor symmetry. And these mass parameters, twisted masses, are called, of course, because they can enter the twisted caravan, and they will enter the, so they will enter the expression of the superpotential. And so you expect, in the presence of twisted masses, the central charge is shifted. So if a mass, if a particle has a certain flavor charge, you get an extra contribution proportional to the mass. Now, if I didn't, so this seems to indicate that lambda should possibly have some poles whose residues are the masses. Now, if you imagine coupling this theory to four-dimensional gauge theory, you can see rather easily that the way the four-dimensional field is coupled to the two-dimensional theory is that roughly the Coulomb graph parameters for the four-dimensional theory behave like twisted masses. So in particular, the particles of your two-dimensional theory, the particles that are living on this domain wall, or sorry, on the surface of the record, can carry gauge charges. So if they carry gauge charges, the central charge will have to accommodate them the usual way. So A and AB will also enter the expression for the central charge. But the statement that the central charge is the integral from I to J of lambda still remains true, because the central charge is still the difference in the value of the twisted potential from the two sides, just that the path that you're using to compare them might be different. So in particular, it means that if I have two particles which have the same between the two vacua, which have different gauge charges, I predict that QE, delta QE dot A plus delta QM dot AD plus delta QF dot M should be equal to a closed contour integral of lambda. Right? Because if I do the difference, if I'm doing the difference between the central charges of the two particles, I'm doing the difference between the two paths, between two paths to join the same points. And so I end up getting a single closed path. So it really looks like the sigma is playing the role of a sub-vacant curve. Although sigma here might be whatever dimension you want. If you might have several twisted couplings, so this sub-vacant curve might have dimension bigger than one. But it seems to be true that the periods of the bulk theory might be expressed in terms of closing contour integrals of one form or a sigma. Now, of course, if you want to believe this, you need to believe that there are enough particles living on the surface of the vector so that you know you can actually get some enough A and AEs. I mean, you might in principle think that maybe your surface operator was very simple and your gauge theory was four-dimensional theory was very complicated, and that the particles living on the surface operator would not be able to interact, to couple to all possible gauge fields at the bulk. But you know, you remember that the charge lattice of the bulk theory has all sorts of monotomies, and these monotomies mix among themselves the charges in very complicated ways. Typically, if you start with a very small set of charges and you subject it to all possible monotomies in the unit place in the Coulomb branch, you're going to get the full charge lattice of your theory. So it seems that as long as your surface operator is interesting enough, it automatically has to have information about the full four-dimensional gauge theory. In a sense, here we are predicting that somehow there should exist something like a subalgebraic curve, a subalgebraic differential, whose existence was essentially conjecture in our second lecture, can be proven just by considering surface operators coupled to the four-dimensional theory. So this is starting to get close to a proof that subalgebraic theory applies to all elementary theories. Now, furthermore, we will see very soon, it's pretty easy to find surface operators with a single twisted coupling, for which sigma is truly a Riemann surface, lambda is truly a differential over the Riemann surface. Now, to proceed now, I should tell you a little bit more how the surface operators look like in infrared theory. So in particular, I should describe to you surface operators in an abelian in equilibrium theory. There's a very beautiful set of surface operators defined by Gukov and Witten. Well, they define it for any of four theories, but the definition carries over pretty well to any of two theories. So you have a U1 failure, a U1 gauge theory. You want to define a four-dimension true defect. There are two natural things you can do. First of all, once you're given a two-dimensional surface, you can integrate the gauge, the field factor. So you could add the Lagrangian eta in J of F over the surface operator. And we call the surface operator sigma. Then another thing you can do is you can require a non-trivial monotomy of the gauge field around your defect. So you can require A to behave roughly like alpha delta theta. So you can take the bundle for the U1 bundle associated to your gauge group, gauge fields, and require to create a non-trivial monotomy around the defect. So alpha is naturally valued in the interval from 0 to 2 pi, because a monotomy, I mean, a monotomy of 2 pi is like a Dirac string. It's really invisible. So this is like a Dirac string with a non-integral quantization. And eta is also valued from 0 to 2 pi, again, because the flux is quantized. Now, another fact that Gukov and Witten showed is that if you do electromagnetic duality, alpha goes to eta and eta goes to minus alpha. And it's not that difficult to show. To do electromagnetic duality, essentially, you take your action, you write it in terms of F only, and you add a Lagrange multiplier to ensure that F is D of something. And then you integrate away F. Having a term like this
It's essentially like saying that DAD must have a delta function singularity proportional to eta, which is the same thing as saying that AD will have will behave like eta delta theta, and vice versa. So it's very convenient actually to combine alpha and eta into a single holomorphic coupling, which will behave like a twisted coupling in the for the surface operator. In a sense, you could write these two couplings together as you can interpret them as adding a twisted superpotential localized on sigma to your four-dimensional theory, which is just the integral of the square theta of the superfield of the the superfield which starts with the Coulomb branch with a scalar field and then that's the Gaginos and then and the field strengths, subdual field strengths, etc. Okay, so in this sense, T is a twisted coupling. Now, if you consider your infrared abelian gauge theory, so you put a surface operator in ultraviolet, you look what you see in infrared, and I had this assumption that I'll motivate soon that the surface operator will have no massless degrees of freedom on the world volume, but only massive particles. So if there are no degrees of freedom on leaving the surface operator, all that I can have is only that I can be left with is one of these abelian surface operators. So furthermore, I expect to see some TIs, which are the parameters for the various gauge fields in infrared. So I goes from one to the rank. And furthermore, just by supersymmetry, I can constrain the way the Coulomb branch fields interact with the surface operator and argue that the interaction should be controlled by an effective twisted superpotential function of A, but then also, of course, of mu and whatever other parameters I have of M. But anyway, function of A. And if I expand these, I just get that I have some alpha i's and eta i's. Such that eta I plus tau, I should put my write this down, sorry. Eta, and these are two. Eta I plus tau ij alpha j is tau j, is tau I, and is dw over dai. So essentially what happens here is that when I do the second, when I integrate twice in the square theta, I get a true fermion term, and I get something that looks like dw. I will remove effective. I will suppress effective on that point. So you get something like this, integrated over sigma. So f plus star f. And then this corresponds to, so you see that plus complex conjugate. So you see that you can relate eta and alpha to the W over the A. So what's interesting is that we know that eta and alpha have these periodicities of 2 pi. And this means that if I take a stroll in parameter space, if I integrate over a path gamma dti over the z, actually, I'm sorry, here I used an index I, which was probably not the same as this index I, so let me make this index I capital. I hope the size of the indices is legible. So I is an index that labels the fields, the bulk fields, different bulk fields. Okay, so if I do this integral, I'm going to get the difference in the values of the t's before and after the monotony. So I get some delta ti, which is really delta alpha I, delta eta I plus, right, plus delta alpha I tau ij, which then must be equal to 2 pi, a multiple of 2 pi plus tau ij times a multiple of 2 pi. Again, this is a very familiar formula from sub-Evitan theory. If I take the derivative of my sub-Evitan differential with respect to some Coulomb branch parameter, I get neuromorphic differentials, holomorphic differentials on my sub-Evitan curve, whose periods are either integers or multiples of tau ij. If I integrate an holomorphic differential properly normalized on an A cycle, I get an integer. If I integrate it on a B cycle, I get the period matrix on my surface. So in a sense, this confirms or reinforces this conclusion that the sigma plays the role of the sub-Evitan curve and lambda of the sub-Evitan differential.
So does that only preserve the break only to U1? Or can you, I mean, you could.
No, so this is a generic, completely generic operator, but in the infrared. Now, when I call this curve, this was a surface operator which had a single parameter, twisted coupling. But in the rest of the seminar, when I refer to curve, it might be an higher dimensional manifold. In any case, I think...
We're only discussing the infrared description.
Yeah, for now it's only the infrared description. Next, I would like to actually give a ultraviolet description. The same way as yesterday we defined some whistle loops, some tooth loops in ultraviolet. I would like to give a concrete realization of the ultraviolet loop, of the ultraviolet surface operators. And I can just borrow the Abelian definition. So the idea is that I can just pick any U1 embedding inside my gauge book and put a U1 surface operator in there. More precisely, I can ask for the gauge field, for the non-Abelian gauge field, to behave like some alpha and theta. But now alpha is an element of the Cartan of my gauge book. And similarly coupled to a eta f or sigma, where I can, to present for symmetry, should have alpha and eta aligned inside the algebra. So this breaks part of the gauge symmetry, essentially to the commutant of one vector in the Cartan. This sort of subgroups that commute a single vector in the Cartan, often called Levy subgroups.
So there will be some subgroup L of G of the gauge group, which computes this alpha. And this subgroup will typically have a bunch of one factors. That's something semi-simple. Actually, if alpha is a generic element in the Cartan, it only commutes with Cartan, other Cartan elements. So for a generic alpha, I break my gauge group to the Cartan, to the torus, to the Abelian torus, and I have a maximum number of U1s, one for each. I mean, n is equal to the rank. But if I have R U1s, I can really, it means that the space of possible deformations for my surface operator is pretty large, as dimension R. Essentially, for each of these U1s, I could deform alpha by taking alpha hat plus delta alpha hat. But delta alpha hat lives in any of these U1 subgroups without changing the subgroup of the gauge group which I'm preserving. So a generic surface operator, a surface operator for generic alpha is going to have a parameter space of twisted couplings, which has rather high dimension. These guys surely are interesting to study, but for my purpose, I would like to focus on surface operators which have one single U1 factor in the commutator. It's not different to write them down. For UN, SUN gauge group, I can just take alpha from this form. So that it commutes only with itself and with an SUN minus 1. In particular, for SU2, whatever alpha I pick, whatever hat I pick, it's going to always have this form and commute it with a single U1. And what are the backlog of the surface operators? Well, I'm trying to give an expectation value to A near the surface operator, but if I'm in the Coulomb branch, the orthogonal components of A are massive. So really, if I want to have a square symmetric surface operator in infrared, it must be true that the expectation value of the Higgs fields I hope that my A's and my alphas are distinguishable. Must commute with this alpha, so they must be diagonal at the same. In particular, that means that this n minus 1 element should be here, or here, or here, or here, or here, or here, in the ratio. So you get n different vacua. In particular, for SU2, your alpha parameter in the infrared will be a plus or minus alpha in the UV. In a sense, alpha was defined after that from the Vi group in ultraviolet, and you get more possibilities in infrared. So this sort of very simple ultraviolet surface operator gives you an infrared surface operator with two vacua. And in particular, now you can also ask what is the twisted tunnel length for this surface operator. Because I did not add any new degrees of freedoms, I should make twisted Carnot operators out of the fields of the bulk theory. And really, all you can do is take phi and restrict it to sigma, and it will give you a twisted Carnot operator. In particular, for SU2, so your phi has this form A minus A. And it means that so this gives you a generator for the carving, which I call X. Well, let me say this right. More precisely, you can do something like trace of phi 1 minus 1. So your twisted Carnot field will be the restriction of A to sigma. Okay. There are two buffers, so you expect to see a test currently for the form x squared equals to something. Okay? Let me call this. This something will depend on the on pure cavalet. Just like contact P. And lambda is x. Expectation value of x, the t. So you have an equation lambda squared equals to phi shu of t, the t squared. So we recall the subvariant curve of the general form, which we discussed at the end of the second lecture. So it appears by setting up one of these very basic surface operators in any of the SU2 gauge groups of our T, G, and theories will produce, we might be able to reproduce the subvariant curve of T1G. Now, for this to be true, something quite interesting must happen or perturbative to the surface operator. You know, very, very naively, this parameter T, which was alpha hat tau uv plus eta. So this parameter was naively was just living in a torus. Instead, now you want this parameter to live on whatever demand surface was associated to our four dimensional gauge theory. So how does that come about? Well, let's start with, as usual, pure SU2, which means net equal to zero. SU2 gauge theory with no hypermultiples. We would like to be able to see if we can somehow reproduce the curve which I formed. Now, let me go to semi-classical regime. So in studying the properties of the surface operator, we don't need to be too concerned with the dynamics of the four-dimensional theory, because the dynamics are semi-classical. Well, then, you know, approximately x hat equals A. This was a sort of a classical relation. This could have quantum corrections the same way as the relation trace of phi squared equals u equal to 2a squared got one instanton corrections. So now this relation up there might get corrections to two-dimensional instantons and two four-dimensional instantons. But in first approximation, you get lambda squared equals to a squared, the t squared, which is the same as saying chu u that is squared. Now, when is this approximation good? Well, if I look at this relation, notice that tau ultraviolet appears here. Tau ultraviolet is the bare coupling in the Lagrangian and gets severely renormalized in the pure SU2. So in particular, if you remember, we got the coupling tau was logarithm of a to the 4, approximately logarithm I over pi, logarithm of a to the 4 to the lambda to the 4. So in a sense, if you define your ultraviolet theory at some scale lambda, it means that the UV gauge coupling was very weak. So, this theory is asymptotically free, so the UV gauge coupling is very weak, and tau is very large.
in ultraviolet. The imaginary part of tau is very large in ultraviolet, which means that although the range of alpha was between 0 and 2 pi, the range of T is in the infrared, in the imaginary direction, is very large. So T really lives in a very long on a very long cylinder. And the size of this cylinder must be of the order of logarithm of lambda square over of lambda to the fourth over I, a to the fourth. I mean, let me be more precise. Not much the size of the cylinder, right? Rather, the range of T for which this description is valid. I mean, it doesn't. So it's possible to argue that the two-dimensional instantons for this surface operator are actually pretty suppressed in this weak coupling limit. As long as your alpha is away from true critical values. These critical values are 0 and pi. Because when alpha is 0, you're sort of removing your surface operator from there. There is no singularity anymore in the gauge fields. And something interesting must be happening. You're sort of trying to restore the gauge symmetry that broke. I'll say it better in a moment. But for now, let me just argue that this value for the current relation for the curve should be valid more or less on a long tube, and I normalize things so that this tube goes from minus log of lambda squared over a squared to plus log of lambda squared over a squared. Now this is perfectly consistent with having this equation, as long as z was roughly e to the 2 pi I t. Okay. So that this is more or less the range over which this term dominates over the other two. So this is just to argue that somehow this semi-classical description is valid as long as the dynamics on the bulk and on the surface operators are weakly coupled. But something strongly coupled must be happening as T becomes very large or very small. Now, there is an alternative way to think about this surface operator. So the surface operator broke as you chew to U1. So a way to describe this breaking is that you could add some auxiliary degrees of freedom there, living in CP1, which is as you chew mode U1, which parameterize the direction in which you're breaking supersymmetry. These degrees of freedoms were the ones that were sort of becoming massive in the Coulomb branch when I said that the surface operator wants to align with the symmetry breaking from the induced by the Higgs field at infinity. But somehow, these degrees of freedom, you can introduce them as auxiliary fields, but anyway, quantum mechanically, they might gain a kinetic term. So there is some sense in which an alternative description of this surface operator might be to couple the SU2 bulk gauge theory to a CP1 sigma model. Vice versa, you could have just taken that as a starting point to ask what happened if you take the SU2 gauge theory in the bulk and couple it to a CP1 sigma model. And to do that, I'll have to now review a little bit how the CP1 sigma model behaves. But in any case, the CP1 sigma model, let me set this right. So if you, just from the classical Lagrangian, which describes the coupling of two-dimensional sigma model to the four-dimensional gauge theory, you can find a very simple fact that if you put your sigma model there, your gauge fields will acquire a monotomy. And the entity of this monotomy, the parameter alpha, will be related to the size of the CP1. So that when alpha is large, the CP1 is big, and the two-dimensional gauge theory, the two-dimensional sigma model is weakly coupled. But when alpha becomes small, it tries to go to zero, which is when you try to go to the endpoint, one of the endpoints of this cylinder, the sigma model, the CP1, the scale of CP1 is becoming very small, and instanton effects become important. Because the instantons in the two-dimensional sigma model are maps from the world volume of the surface operator into CP1, and their action is governed by the size of CP1. Okay, so let me just review some of the properties of the CP1 sigma model. It's also a good way to get a better intuition about this structure. So a good way to describe a CP1 nonlinear sigma model is to use a gauged linear sigma model. So you would consider a 2D theory where you have two chiral fields both of charge one under a 2D gauge field. The field strength of 2D gauge fields live in twisted chiral multiplets. And so I have a coupling of two chiral multiplets and one twisted chiral multiplet. And well, basically, I mean, a U1 gauge field. So when you look at the model space of classical vacua for this theory, you get a D-term relation where T is the so-called Fayette-Leopoldus parameter, and you quotient the space by the U1, you get CP1. Now, CP1 has an SU2 isometry, so the theory has an SU2 flavosymmetry. You can actually add twisted masses for this SU2 flavosymmetry. If you take them in the if you put the mass parameter in the Cartan, this is the same that you give favor charge one and minus one to these two fields. Now, once you give mass to these fields, they are massive, and in particular, if this mass is large compared to the scale at which the gauge coupling becomes strong. Sorry. That was a badly phrased statement, but it's large respect to the scale where the non-perturbative dynamics of the two-dimensional gauge field become important. You can think of just integrating away this gauge field, these chiral fields, and look at the dynamics of the two-dimensional gauge fields alone. When you do that, you get an effective. So this, I said that the field strength of this two-dimensional gauge field lives in the twisted chiral field, and its dynamics are really controlled by the effective twisted potential for this twisted chiral field. So if you integrate, so you originally have, if I call this the twisted chiral spur field sigma, I'm sorry for using the same symbol that I use for the surface operator, but the alternative is using capital sigma, which is probably the worst choice. So I start with the twisted spur potential T sigma, which gave me the Fayette-Leopoldus parameter. I integrate away the chiral fields with mass m and minus m, and up to some factors of pi that I don't think I would get right, but I can try. You get these one loop corrections to the twisted potential. Now, sigma is a twisted chiral field which contains the two-dimensional field strength.
So this is a dimensional reduction of the usual gauge multiplet in four dimensions. So this sigma is really the, so if you start with the gauge field with four components, two become scalars, two dimensions, and two remain gauge fields. So these are the two scalars combined together into a complex scalar. Now, if I now look for vacua by optimizing the single potential, I get equations like T plus 2 pi IT equals logarithm sigma plus n plus logarithm sigma minus n, which is the same as saying that sigma squared minus m squared equal to e to the 2 pi IT. Now, this sigma squared was really you should think of this sigma as being the same as Rxf in the other blackboard. Moreover, if I'm coupling this CP1 sigma model to the SU2 gauge theory, so I said that this mass parameter was the mass parameter in the Cartan of the spherical symmetry. Now I'm gauging this spherical symmetry with a four-dimensional gauge field, and it's easy to show that this M should be identified with A. So I learned that as long as the description of in terms of the CP1 sigma model weakly coupled to the four-dimensional gauge field is correct, my lambda, so the x to z, lambda squared should have the form e to the 2 pi it plus 2u plus there. No. So now I gave a description for the surface operator in a regime, in a different regime. I'm sort of learning what's happening in this direction. And you can repeat the exercise, coupling this CP1 sigma model in a slightly different way. So it corresponds to alpha equal to pi instead of alpha equal to 0. And you learn what happens in this direction. Here, okay. I've been a bit covered there with the gauge coupling skills, but you can recognize that under this identification, the expected Salvitian curve for the QSU is emerging. First time in a surface operator. It also learned that it seems to be quite a thing to study behavior with surface operators in details. I mean, people have developed such beautiful techniques to the mirror of symmetry to study two-dimensional two sigma models, and I think it would be very nice to understand if some of those techniques can be extended to sigma models coupled to four-dimensional each theory. But doing things by hand, you can more or less get the correct answer for pure SU2, or SU2 with some NF equal to 1 or 2. Of course, we would like to understand at least what happens to SU2 and F equal to 4, which was the basic building block for the theories we discussed in the first lecture. Now,
why did you consider this separators and separators where phi in principle there are also beta gamma, right?
So I want surface operators to preserve a certain type of supersymmetry. I think the ones which phi gets thefts, similarities would be 0.4 and 2.2.
Oh, you want the common rule sigma
model? That's right. That's right. 0.4 sigma defects are also rather interesting, but 0.4 sigma models are less well understood. So I prefer to focus on the 2.2. Furthermore, it seems that the 0.4 are more relevant to study what happens in the Higgs branch rather than the Coulomb branch. Anyway, so I'm not going to be able to give you something logically tight for SU2 and F equal to 4, but I would like at least to show you that you can get quite far with some very basic assumptions. So SU2 and F equal to 4 is a conformal field theory if I turn off all the masses. And it's perfectly possible for a surface operator to be superconformal there are half of the square conformal symmetries, not just the supersymmetries. So for that to be true, the volume theory should preserve any 2.2 superconformal symmetry, which means that you don't just want any sigma model. So if one breaks superconformal symmetry, although naively it's a sigma model, so classically it's scale invariant, but mechanically you get a dimensional transmutation, your Phi Leopold's parameter becomes a scale. The theory is massive different. To get it's actually pretty easy to kill the beta function for the Ferretti Leopold's parameter just by adding a few more fields up there. So the simplest possible model I can think of, which I could couple to an SU2VH theory, so it has SU2 frequency symmetries, and has no beta function for the Ferretti Leopold's parameter, is a conical. Two fields of charge one, and two fields of charge minus one. Okay. Now, so this theory, that the F-term equations make sense for both positive and negative t. So you have a region where t is much bigger than zero when you have roughly, so you have a CP1 and a two-dimensional complex space bubble over it. You get a conical resolved one way. And you can go to t much smaller than zero, and you get the difference in one. So here your true flavor has two flavor symmetries. One rotates the CP1 that appears at large t, the other rotates the CP1 that appears at small t. So in particular, now if I repeat the exercise that I had over there, now I get something like sigma minus M1, sigma minus M2, over sigma minus M3, sigma minus M4, equals e to the 2 pi I t. Let's just call this z in there. And I can manipulate this Carnot relation a little. At the moment, it doesn't quite look like a Carnot relation because it's not polynomial, but I can just bring this on the other side. And I get something like sigma minus M1, sigma minus M2, equals z, sigma minus M3, sigma minus M4. So if I collect the same powers of sigma, I will have, I get z minus 1, sigma squared plus some linear polynomial in z, so it will be something like z minus c1 z plus c2 sigma plus c3 z plus c4 equals 0. Now, finally, if I want to get an expression for sigma, so this is the Carnot relation tells me that sigma squared can be expressed in terms of sigma and a constant. I can always shift sigma so that I get I write that like sigma equal to x hat minus 1/2 c1z plus c2 over z minus 1. And so at the end, I get something like x squared equals to z minus 1 squared. And then it behaves a second degree polynomial afterwards. Or lambda squared is equal to z squared, z minus 1 squared, this is squared, p2 of z. So this looks definitely like a piece of the subalgebraic curves for the theories we studied in the first lecture. Indeed, it has quadratic. This quadratic differential has double poles at 0, 1, and infinity. So it's like a three-dimensional sphere. And so if I couple this sigma model to an S2NF equal to 4, I can at least imagine that now this side of the cylinder will be replaced by the three-dimensional sphere. So I have two punctures and the third puncture is, well, it's a patch of the cylinder. And here, the same. And I will end up with four punctures here. And maybe, and you know, this guy has true as you choose level symmetry, so I can actually teach true as you choose to it. You can really use it as a junction between at least two cubes. And now, something I don't quite understand. So the original sigma model only had true as you choose level symmetries, but the Karajan relation treats 0, 1, and infinity in pretty much the same way, and the corresponding mass parameters pretty much the same way. So I don't quite know if I should expect the two-dimensional sigma model to have a secret S2-level symmetry which is emerging only in infrared, a third one. So it's really a three-dimensional sphere. Or if this is true only if I couple it somehow to the blocks of hypermultiplets that were the three-dimensional sphere, four-dimensional cube. So I think that's one of the questions that, yeah, I don't know the answer to, and I'd really like to know the answer to. Anyway, so it looks like at least intuitively, you can imagine constructing the subalgebraic curve for all the theories in the field, G, N+. Now, I promised a second way to give a physical interpretation of that curve. I have 20 minutes available, so let me see if I can do something about it. I think I will give you half of the story today and tomorrow. I will need the other half because it's anyway needed for the useful for the comparison to living theory. So let me see if I have anything backwards. Yeah. Oops. So so I want to build four-dimensional theories starting from the data of a famous surface. And, you know, another possible thought is that maybe if I start from some six-dimensional theory and I compactify it on a famous surface, I might recover a four-dimensional theory. Now, the first naive guess would be to look at the six-dimensional Yamil's theory. Now, that doesn't sound like a very good idea because the six-dimensional Yamil's theory is not asymptotically free. And moreover, if you reduce a six-dimensional gauge field on a Riemann surface, what I'm going to get is a four-dimensional gauge field plus a bunch of scalars. Multiplying a basis of one forms on your Riemann surface. So this reduction will give me one gauge, four-dimensional gauge field, and a whole bunch of scalars, which is not what I want. What I wanted was a whole bunch of gauge fields associated with cycles of the Riemann surface. So the simple way out is instead of looking at six-dimensional gauge field, I look at six-dimensional true forms. Then I'm going to get a four-dimensional true form, but it's the same as a scalar, and a whole bunch of interesting gauge fields. Associated with the cycles for the Riemann surface. Now, this had a little bit too many gauge fields because I wanted a gauge field for every A cycle in the Riemann surface, and somehow the B cycles are associated to the electromagnetic dual gauge fields. But it's easy to accomplish. Just need my F, my B, to be a self-dual true form. Well, precisely the field strength built out of B to be self-dual. If the field strength built out of B is self-dual, then here we'll also get another scalar. From the true form on the surface. But so self-duality relates this true form and the scalar and relates A and AB. Basically DA is directly DAB, which is exactly the sort of relation that we wanted to have. So it looks like if I reduce a true form with a dual field strength on a Riemann surface, I might recover something that looks like the Fred the abelian gauge theory on the Coulomb branch of further rational theory. Of course, I need to supersymmetrize this. There's a beautiful way to supersymmetrize the theory of two-form field, which is to consider a tensor multiple in six dimensions. So this will contain D, contain fermions, will contain five scalars. So if I want, now, this is a supersymmetric theory in flat dimensional space. We want a theory that is supersymmetric in four dimensions and can be quantified on a Riemann surface. We can accomplish that by a twist of this theory. It's a free theory anyway. And when you do the twist, this theory had five scalars rotated by an SO5 symmetry. You need to pick an SO2 inside SO5 and twist. And when you do that, sure, this scalar becomes one force on the Riemann surface. So in infrared, I'm going to get these three scalars together with the scalar that comes out of the true form. That forms the free hypermultiplet, which is completely free, that couples from everything I will just drop. And I get some four-dimensional decays of freedoms, which come out of the reduction of the from the four-dimensional gauge fields, together with whatever fluctuations of the scalar field. Okay? And automatically, the gauge couplings for these gauge fields will be the same as the period matrix for the Riemann surface. And actually, the actual metric on the Riemann surface completely drops out from the four-dimensional Lagrange. Only the complex structures survive. This has to do with the twist. Okay, well, this was not... So this was just a way, a gimmick, if you want to produce the infrared four-dimensional theory out of some free six-dimensional theory. What I really want to do is to find an ultraviolet six-dimensional theory which would flow to the ultraviolet four-dimensional theory, which would describe the four-dimensional ultraviolet theory and then possibly flow to this description. Now, notice that so this x to the z plays the same role as the subrivetian differential. So, furthermore, this six-dimensional theory is the theory that lives on the volume of a single five-ring. So, why not to consider an five-ring which wraps the subrivetian curve x squared equal to phi shu of z? Now, for this equation to make sense, this is the equation tau of C, where C was the curve discussed in the first lecture. So I can take, this defines the curve sigma inside this tau of C. So I want to wrap an M5 ring on this curve inside this tau of C. And then this M5 ring will have a four remaining directions in the volume over which the four-dimensional theory lives. Now, the interesting point is that if I just turn off the mass parameters and I move to the alternate column branch, so that phi 2 becomes 0, what I get are daily 2 and phi minus roughly C. And the column branch of the theory is described by the way these 2 and 5 minutes can recombine into a single object inside this kind of circuit. Now, the volume theory of 2 and 5 minutes is not a cute, free, six-dimensional theory. Instead, it's a very mysterious, square conformal theory in six dimensions called the 2,0 theory. When I write something like this, it really means that I'm ignoring the possibility that two and five will move together. I'm only interested in the relative motion of two and five waves. So actually, if I look at it for volume theory of two and five waves, there will be a copy of this trivial theory which describes the motion of the center of mass, and then a very interesting six-dimensional theory, in one theory, which describes the relative motion of the five waves. So, finally, I get to the point that maybe I should study what happens if I put this 2,0 six-dimensional theory on C, inside this kind of C. Well, now, forget about this kind of C. This just means that I put the six-dimensional theory on C, and I twist it, so that the degree of freedom to describe the motion transverse to C actually valued in one form. Okay. So now I have a well-defined UV theory, six dimensions. I can wrap it on my favorite curve. I can even allow this curve to have some punctures. There are two different ways to do that. I can just say, if I want to put the theory on a four-puncture sphere, I could just take a metric on a four-puncture sphere where it has four long cubes coming out. Now, the basic property of the six-dimensional theory is that if I reduce it on a circle, I get five-dimensional Young Mills. So here, essentially, I'm getting five-dimensional Young Mills on some long, on some half lines. But it's an infrared free theory. Once I plot an infrared, it doesn't really contribute any dynamics, interesting dynamics. But, and then there is some interesting dynamics coming from the laser two joints. An alternative point of view is that I grab 25 rings on the sphere, but I also grab some and five rings on the tangent to the sphere. And the presence of these five rings gives you more or less the same behavior as you get from here. So in a sense, these are different. As I said, the metric on the Riemann surface doesn't seem to matter much for what four-dimensional theory you get. So you can describe your singularities or punctures in different ways, which are different in six dimensions, but flow to the same place in four dimensions. Anyway, so this is a construction of a class of theories which have a parameter space of couplings which construct the complex structure of the surface and has all the properties of the theories we were working with in the first lecture. So now you might try to argue that these theories coincide with the ones that we discussed in the first lecture. So the idea is that you can take your Riemann surface. And go to a region of the couplings where your handles are becoming thin. Okay? So the six dimensional theory on each of these handles really looks like five dimensional Young Mills. SU2 by dimensioning in mils on a segment. And if you believe that the boundary conditions that you get are more or less Neumann, five-dimensional mils on a segment is going to give so five-dimensional mil theory on a segment is going to give you four-dimensional mils in the infrared. And if you look, I mean, the gauge coupling of the five-dimensional mil theory is related to the size of the circle. Then the coupling of the four-dimensional theory is related to the coupling of the five-dimensional theory and to the length of the segment this way. But the coupling of the five-dimensional theory was squared was proportional to the radius, so you get L over R. So you see that the four-dimensional gauge coupling really only depends on the complex structure of this long tube. So you reduce the problem to understanding what happens, what comes up with the three-quantum spheres. So you go to the point where you can claim that these theories in various corners of the moduli for the parameter space are represented by some generalized quiver, so you have four-dimensional gauge groups coupled to this pair of pants theories that are labeled by three-quantum spheres. They need to work a bit harder to show that these three-quantum spheres for SU2 are just a bunch of other multipliers. There are various ways, but the easier is just to remember and construct an important construction to build them, to engineer an equal two theories out of brains. So the way we can engineer an equal four, an F equal SU2 and F equal to four, will be to start with two default brains and intersect them with two and S5 brains. So the default brains break at the S5 brains. So you get the theory leading on the segments of the four brains. This is again five-dimensional mils on a segment, so it's four-dimensional SU2 gauge theory. And then you get extra degrees of freedom from the strings stretched across the S5 brains. This gives hypermultiplets in the fundamental of the SU2. So you get 1, 2, 3, 4 hypermultiplets in the fundamental of SU2. And the way Witten computes the Sarov-Witten curve for the theory is by observing that really the tight wave picture is not very good in the field theory limit. It's good in ultraviolet, but not in the infrared. And by the time you go to the infrared, you should replace this tight wave picture with an anterior picture. Basically, what's going on is that the dilaton becomes large near the default brains. I mean, and to flow, you know, holographically, to flow to the infrared, you go near the set of brains. So you should, if the dilaton is large, you should look at the theory, not the patch wave. When you leave this to theory, what you get is 2 or 5 brains on a cylinder from the default brains intersecting at the 2 and 5 brains at the 2 points on the cylinder. So this is more or less a hybrid of the picture I was writing there. I get the volume theory of 2 and 5 brains on a cylinder with 2 punctures, 2 defects that correspond to this transverse and 5 brains. And so once I accept the punctures I get by having wrong cubes are the same as the punctures I get by transverse and 5 brains, then I can compare this picture with a picture of the series for punctures and argue that that I identified correctly the basic building blocks of the six-dimensional theory. Now, all of this construction, which I really sketched very quickly now, has the main defect that the six-dimensional theory has no Lagrangian, no very good definition. You know that it exists as a volume theory of 2 and 5, but you know that it's a field theory. A good field theory is not an exotic theory, but still you don't know how to define it. that is non-non-abelian version in the theory of two forms. So, but it has advantages. For example, you can argue that the surface operators in the four-dimensional theory correspond to M2 brains ending on the system of five brains. So this would be M2 brains which, so then five brains were wrapping C inside the star of C times R4, R3,1. Then you can take M2 brains which sit at a point in C and extend, leaving R,1 inside R,1, and then extend as a half line in an orthogonal direction. So these are really probes. They are not dynamical objects. They are, if you add them, you're really modifying the theory on this plane. And they have one parameter, one complex parameter, which is the location of C. So you learn that these theories really have surface operators, which are parameterized by whose parameter space coincides with the curve C. So that the sort of construction we're attempting here comes out very naturally from six dimensions. All these surface operators will have essentially two vacua, which are the choice of which and five does this and two way end on. And and you can reconstruct the whole structure. So what I want to keep in mind, the main point I want to stress is that this makes it clear that somehow the surface operator, the parameter of the surface operator is free to explore the whole Riemann surface. This was very far from obvious from the four-dimensional description. For the four-dimensional description, I define my surface operator as different in one of the gauge groups. And the fact that if I tune the parameters, I can go and explore a region of parameter space, so this should be described by a surface operator for another SU2 gauge is quite surprising. So in a sense, from the four-dimensional gauge theory point of view, I define a bunch of apparently distinct surface operators. If one has a cylinder as a parameter space, and towards the end of the cylinder, the description becomes bad. Non-perturbative effects should kick in. And this predicts that all these parameter spaces are actually glued together to form a Riemann surface. And I think it's really nice to have a direct derivation of this fact using technology for Mears symmetry or whatnot, instanton countings, etc. Okay. Any questions?
You said that a 5D gauge theory on an interval is equivalent to a 4D one. What is the argument here?
Well, if you have Neumann boundary conditions, then you have zero modes in the five-dimensional theory, which are the four-dimensional, which behave like four-dimensional gauge fields. And then you have Kaluza Klein modes.
Mm-hmm. So at least you have a subset of.
It's like, so you should.
So what about the excited modes? Do you?
You should be. So I'm trying to set up a sort of a careful, playing with the scales carefully. So I started a six-dimensional theory compactified on the Riemann surface. I can sort of play with the magic on this Riemann surface. And what I get in the far infrared would be the same. Then I can try to play with this magic in such a way that I get a theory which first flows to the ultraviolet four-dimensional theory and then flows to the four-dimensional infrared theory. So in this first step, I use all the Kaluza-Klein modes on the Riemann surface, but I keep the non-abelian four-dimensional gauge dynamics. And then I...
But why can you ignore the Kaluza-Klein modes when this interval is...
So their mass is controlled by the metric at the Riemann surface, while the mass of the W bosons or something like that is controlled by the complex structure. So I can really
you
put
can,
a very
you
large.
Can turn the mass up.
Yeah, I can tune the mass of the color quite much higher. Actually, the way the color kind of modes work when you go from 60 to 5D is pretty mysterious. Because the color kind of modes, I mean, states with momentum in the sixth direction are supposed to coincide with states in the five dimensional theory, which carry instanton charge. So, in a sense, they are still there. And,
so that's even the Kaluza-Klein modes around the small direction.
That's right.
They still seem to be there in the 5D.
Yes. And then, so when you go from 5D to 4D, those are there. Right. I mean, it's somehow peculiar that the four-dimensional gauge cap you get was given by the ratio of the two lengths. Instead of being. You know, if I was reducing a naive four-dimensional theory in Lagrangian, I would get a factor of R and then a factor of L. I would get the area of the Riemann surface in front of the Lagrangian. So the fact that I'm starting the theory without the Lagrangian is really. Well, okay, shouldn't say that. Because when I reduce the set world tree form, same thing happens. But definitely, there is something interesting. In the fact that it's the complex structure that covers that appears in front of the four-dimensional kinetic curves, while the area will appear in front of the Kaluza-Klein modes.
Okay.